Fran Greaves, wife of Charlotte Observer food critic Paul Greaves, says she puts in the greatest amount of effort possible when making lasagna for her spouse.
I bought the freshest ingredients from the farmer's market, and I'm making the pasta from scratch with the finest semolina flour. But I still can't shake the feeling that it won't be good enough for Paul.
Greaves' husband has been previously disappointed by his wife's bland chicken marsala, uninspired veal schnitzel, and a lemon chiffon cake that was a bit on the sweet side.
Okay, welcome back. Bit of a public service announcement here. Stay the hell away from Kashi cereal. There's nothing wrong with it per se. It's great stuff, always tastes great. No recalls, nothing really unhealthy about it. Just for me, and apparently I'm not alone because this happens with other people I've talked to, when I eat this stuff, I turn into Emeril Lagasse.
Bam!
Honestly, that's twice that I've eaten a different type of Kashi breakfast cereal, and twice I've spent nearly the entire day outdoors so I wasn't forced to repaint the walls in my house. Brutal. I think it's back to Fruit Loops for me. I don't know what the hell they put in this stuff, but it upsets my stomach, something awful. The first box I tried was some kind of bird seed, and it began to make sense why my car windshield always looks like someone hit it with a bottle of Whiteout. I mean, they should put a warning on those boxes. That's one of those things you should eat while you're on the toilet. Goes through you faster than Johnny Depp goes through money. Had a bit of a shocker recently. I don't pay much attention to the personal lives of chefs or food writers all that much. So I really don't monitor the gossip sites or anything like that. Not that this would have been all that high profile or anything. But I follow Michael Ruhlman on Twitter and Instagram. And I saw a post from him a couple weeks ago of his son reading a poem. Now, I wouldn't have known it was his son because the last time I saw this kid on camera, he was 11 years old, and now he's like 18 or something. Anyway, Ruhlman wrote something like, "My kid did a great read of this poem at our wedding." And I thought, wedding? What wedding? Then I start digging further, and I see a photo of Ruhlman kissing some woman in front of a bunch of people, and I realized he got married to someone other than his wife Donna, who was the photographer who shoots all the photos for his blog and stuff. So I go back to his blog, which I hadn't been to in a while, since cancer, and I see a post from last September where he announced that he and Donna had gotten a divorce. Now, I don't know Ruhlman personally. I've talked to him a few times about my adventures in charcuterie, and I helped him fix a few things on his blog when he first launched it. Because if you know anything about content management systems like WordPress or Typepad, they can be a real pain in the ass for non-technical people. But that's the limit to the amount of, you know, conversations I've had with him. A couple times on Twitter. Jo actually talked to him a lot. She helped him through his daughter's Tasmanian devil years, you know, 13 through 17. Apparently his daughter was acting like a grade A bitch, which is normal. But it seemed like he had a nice marriage. But who really knows? You know, you don't know people. You don't know what's happening in their life. Apparently he remarried a writer. I think she's a novelist in New York. And now he doesn't live in Cleveland anymore. Now he lives in New York. Bourdain also got divorced, but he made his kind of public. And he said the very same things you would expect him to say. I work too much. It's not conducive to a marriage. I travel too much. Now, I could be wrong, and I don't want to start any rumors, but the next thing you know, he's dating this Italian actress who just happens to have been his tour guide when he did the Rome episode of Parts Unknown on CNN. Now, listen, he films this stuff 6 months or more before the show airs and announces his separation from Octavia about a month or so after the episode airs. And you can see how flirty these two are when they're cruising around Rome. And I'm not big on picking up signals. Listen, Michelle tells me this all the time. That girl is flirting with you. No, she's not. Yes, she is. But it doesn't really take a genius to figure out that she wanted that soprasetta that Bourdain was packing in his pants. You could tell. And again, who knows? I don't want to spread rumors. But by the way he was flirting back with her, couldn't take that shit-eating grin off his face? Maybe he made her a sandwich before he boarded the plane back home. What, you don't think Octavia sees that episode and doesn't think something's up, and then he announces they're separating? Come on, huh? So that's two strikes for Bourdain, and I really feel bad for him. For his family, really. I honestly thought that this is the one that would last. They seem like a good couple. They have a daughter. His wife is on the show with him a lot. He does MMA now with her. He's ripped like a motherfucker now, too. That pot belly's gone. I saw him with a shirt off on Instagram. He's pretty ripped. She got him to stop smoking, too. After all those years he was smoking. I mean, it looked promising. It was a good marriage. I'm sad for them. I'm sad for his daughter, really. Divorced parents? I know the drill. A lot of you know the drill. But at least they've devoted themselves to keeping that family unit as solid as possible. They did Christmas together and everything. So, good luck. Anyway, I guess my point here is that nothing stays the same forever. Times change. People change. The world is constantly evolving. Did I expect to be here, widowed, talking about these things? Remarried? No. But we move forward, reinvent ourselves, and look at new challenges, and we really have to do the best with that.
I'm going to be an expat too soon. I'm thinking of getting an Italian passport.
Are you really?
Yeah.
You?
Yeah. Bad times in my country, man. Bad times.
It's like Spain
in like 1936.
You told me something very interesting about beer the first time that we met, Albert.
Uh-huh.
You have all this great alcohol, but you have basically one or two kinds of beer. And I was like, well, you know, why don't you have a few different beers? He said, well, you know what, in Spain, una cerveza fría...
Es una buena cerveza.
Es una buena cerveza.
But I mean, when you say, look, I like cold beer. The people who make, they're fanatics who make craft beers. And I get, the angriest mail I get are from people who are craft beer enthusiasts.
Right.
I mean, they threaten my life.
In this moment, people talk always modern or traditional cuisine, no? And I say, why always this war? What don't combine together? The tradition and modernity.
Life comes at you fast, as Ferris Bueller used to say. If you blink, you might miss it.
Okay, enough about divorce. That shit is depressing. I did mention Ruhlman and charcuterie, and one more thing on that. He's found a way, and this is brilliant, he found a way to capitalize on something, and if you follow him on Twitter, you'll see a ton of people asking him questions about curing and all that kind of stuff, sending pictures of what they're doing and asking for tips and advice. And that's not something I've ever done, because it's all in his book, and it's written very well, well enough that I think if you follow it, you'll be fine. But people will hit him up with questions constantly, and he's always gracious enough to respond and help people out. But not anymore. He develops this app for your phone that allows you to enter a discussion with him and Brian Polson, who co-wrote the book with him, directly, and have one-on-one chats with them about technicalities and things in regards to making charcuterie. And it's a subscription service, so it's really not all that expensive either. It's like a couple bucks a month. So if you end up doing a lot of curing and aging of meat, it's worth it. And some of the discussions that they showed are pretty deep, like precise temperature control, alternative methods of aging and curing meat. Gets really tricky. Smart move, classy way to get people to stop asking for free advice from someone who definitely deserves to be paid for what they know. And I will tell you a story about my plans to start a meat business. And this was some time ago. 2009. Started back then. It was before Katrina was diagnosed. I wanted to leave my career in advertising and marketing. I wanted to start a meat business. I wanted to work in food. But I was passionate about this. I was going to call it Clooney Palooney Meat Company. Sausages, cured and smoked meats, beef jerky, and I wanted to use locally raised pigs and cows. But there were problems. First of all, there aren't any locally raised pigs around here where I live. I don't live in a farm area. I live in suburbia. And I took a few online courses in food safety, did a ton of research. I mean, I really scoped this thing out. What I found out was that the health department is a royal bitch to deal with. Startup costs are massive. The USDA gets involved. They can be hard to deal with. Then I found some meat sources. But by the time I finished, I was looking at sourcing pigs from Farmer John. So that really didn't go as planned. Then the horror stories began to surface and reality set in. So there's this company that I really started to like their stuff. They were called Knight Salumi. And they were in San Diego somewhere. Amazing salami. I found them in a local Italian deli. And suddenly they disappeared. I didn't find it anymore. I started asking questions. This place ends up getting closed down by the health department because a drain cover on their main floor was a little loose. They came and did an inspection. Oh, this drain cover is not attached properly. So the USDA instructs them to fix the floor drain. And since that required shutting down all of their production, Knight, his last name was Knight, he asked one of his consulting clients, which was a salumi company in St. Louis, if they could co-pack and produce some of the product for him in the meantime while they got this fixed. So they did that, but just before the holidays, big time, when the product was ready to ship, the USDA seized the entire line of production and had it destroyed because the St. Louis plant was missing a signature in its paperwork. Knight tried to fight the USDA, but lost, of course, and then insurance company wouldn't cover the loss. And now the guy's broke and had to dissolve the company. Complete shame. But that's how it is. Then there's Lindy Grundy. This was a high-end butcher shop on Fairfax in L.A. And it was run by these two girls who were absolutely fucking awesome. Joe became friends with them and introduced me. It was my birthday that year. And they gave me a tour of their entire place. Their freezer, I went into the freezer. They had steaks aging. Pigs hanging from hooks. They bought all of their stuff from local farms further north of LA. All boutique animals, heritage breeds, great stuff. They smoked things there, made sausages, everything I was planning on doing except I wasn't going to sell meat, just things that I had processed. And this place was hemorrhaging money. Just to open the place, it was a nightmare. She said they were going through their inspections, and the city notices that a light switch wasn't what they required. It had to be a special light switch that you had to purchase from this one place in LA, and it was something like $300. But it didn't do anything that the original light switch didn't do. It sounded like a total scam. They put their entire life savings into this place, then still had to borrow another $150,000 from their families. And I don't know if it was their operating costs or because of where they were located, but their prices were really high. I mean, listen. I love a good pork chop, but I don't know if I'll shell out $30 for one. I bought a bunch of offal from them, beef tongues, sweetbreads, intestines, liver, brains, and stuff. It was all like $20 a pound and up. Nose-bleedingly expensive, but really good stuff. And that's the cost of really good product. But I have to think the operating costs drove the prices up too. And they too eventually went under because they broke up. Like my friend Jason says, the only kind of ship that sinks is a partnership. I wasn't about to partner with anybody. I wanted to go at this thing alone. Low scale, keep the costs as low as possible. But there was no way I could afford to do it. And I really didn't want to risk quitting my job and spending everything I had and probably everything I didn't have on something that looked so risky. And maybe it failed in my head because I was just too big of a pussy to take that chance, but I don't regret it. Especially, you know, considering what happened afterward. The food business is hard. Even running a gourmet hot dog cart is still something I fantasize about doing. But I've seen so much failure in the food business to want to take that leap. Bobby Bogner and his wife opened The Point in Culver City. And it was doing really well for a few years. It, too, eventually shuttered. You land back on your feet, but it's heartbreaking to lose a restaurant or any business after you pour your heart and soul into it and spend practically every waking hour on it and in it. So, Clooney Palooney, rest in peace in my head.
After listening to the latest episode of the podcast, My Life as a Foodie, I decided to try making kombucha again. It's been several years, so I don't have a viable SCOBY mother anymore. That's a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. I decided to grow a new one, a new SCOBY, from dregs of a commercial bottle. So I posted pics on Twitter and Facebook of the beginnings of my experiment, and several of you were kind enough to chime in with your experience and advice, because you've done the same thing. So I'll talk more about that next week. I'm planning to have Phil from My Life as a Foodie on next week to talk about his kombucha experience. And I might try to get Phil to talk about his Arkansas connection. He has an Arkansas connection quite close to Steve and me. You know, he doesn't sound like he's an Arkansan.
Hey, in case you missed it, I'm the guest on Basic Brewing Radio with James Spencer this week. And it was as outstanding an experience as you'd expect it to be. He asked if I'd be a guest on his show, and I said yes so fast that it was almost embarrassing. Now, he's the godfather of podcasting, if you ask me. I've always looked up to him for what he does and the professional way that he does it. The fact that he even bothers to listen to what I do is a big enough deal, but he actually tells me that he likes the show. The production quality, my stupid sense of humor, even with all the cursing. I mean, the man's a voice actor, for Christ's sake. He's Mr. Radio. And his show's unique in the fact that it's about the basics of brewing, and he can make it really simple. Yet, he can get incredibly detailed about little things with brewers and chemists and really show just how deep the rabbit hole goes in the craft of brewing beer. I had talked about making kombucha a couple weeks ago, and he had already done that about 6 years ago, of course, but wanted to revisit it, so that's what we talked about. Of course, he likes to tinker way more than I often do with flavor, so he's bringing up all kinds of things that I wouldn't have thought of, like hops. So there are a few kombucha brewers out there who have started using hops as a flavoring, and there seems to be a way to do it right and about 200 ways to do it wrong. He found one that isn't available out my way that smelled like fresh hops and tasted like hops too. I found one that said it had hops in it, but didn't taste like much of anything. Like chewing on a rag. You know, you drink a beer, right? And it tastes great. Then, say, 10 minutes later, you belch. And, you know, oh yeah, that beer I just had. With this drink, you belch, and you're not reminded of anything. So James is telling me that he's tried making kombucha with hops before. And with his, he put the hops either in boiling water or really hot water. And, well, listen, even a short boil is going to extract some bitterness from the hops and turn your kombucha into battery acid. So there's some experimentation to happen here. We've decided to experiment together. I'm going to make a batch, and after it ferments, I'm going to dry hop it for a week with whole leaf hops. Then I'm going to bottle it. I think if you apply any kind of heat to hops, you're going to extract oils, and that might screw the pooch. So a dry hop has got to be the way to go. I'm going to work on it along with James. We'll see what happens, let you guys know. If you want to listen, basicbrewingradio.com, in case some of you haven't listened to his show in a while or visited his website. I mean, this man has been doing it for so long, it's insane. Over 500 episodes. He's got videos. He's got DVDs you can watch at home. If you're interested in brewing beer or in any kind of fermentation, even pickling, that's the show. I know I sound like I'm gushing, but I got so excited when he asked me. Michelle looks at me like I've got some kind of a man crush, you know? I told her, listen, this is like being invited to be on Johnny Carson in the 70s. It's that level for a podcaster.
This show will air long after the election. There is actually a national conversation now, unthinkable in my lifetime, where the notion of rounding up however many millions of undocumented workers in this country all at once, or in short order, and then kicking them all out. I mean, it seems unthinkable. But I mean, you know, they said that in Europe in the 30s.
Right, right. No, I think just from a military logistical point of view, there's no way you're going to move the people out of California and out of Los Angeles. I mean, they tried that in 1954, Operation Wetback, mostly from the fields, moving a million people out, right?
And they did.
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, first of all, a huge amount of U.S. citizens were picked up one day and never came home. And families were torn apart. And then the most ironic thing about it, and the most tragic thing, is that the next couple of years they said, you know what, we have to open the borders again to bring them all back, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem was we never stopped wanting the workers. California's the number one agricultural state, and approximately about 70% of the labor force is undocumented.
Stuff would rot in the fields, just to start with.
Right. Because number one, who would grow it and bring it here?
Picking it, packing it, to a great extent, processing it, cooking it,
and serving it, cleaning up after it. I mean, there would not only be no restaurant business, there would be the worst economic crisis in the history of California and the United States.
There's this national discussion about an immigration ban and deportation of Mexicans, or as our standing president puts it, bad hombres. It's unthinkable to me that there's such a wide division in our country about this, but it is what it is. You can't change it. Jose Andreas comes out radically against Trump last year when the news surfaced that the Trump Organization was engaged in a legal battle with Chef Andreas and had been going on for like 2 years. The lawsuit's been settled, but now, back then it concerned a restaurant deal that Andreas pulled out of after Trump had made comments disparaging Mexicans. Jose's restaurant was going to be inside Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., and then things went to shit in 2015. Trump made all these disparaging comments about Mexicans, called them rapists, said they were bringing drugs and crime into the U.S. So Jose says, screw this, pulls out of the deal, and Trump ends up suing him for $10 million in a breach of contract suit. So Jose and his restaurant group then countersues for $8 million, saying that Trump's comments had hurt business. And I quote, "The perception that Mr. Trump's statements were anti-Hispanic made it very difficult to recruit appropriate staff for a Hispanic restaurant to attract the requisite number of Hispanic food patrons for a profitable enterprise and to raise capital for what was now an extraordinarily risky Spanish restaurant." What we as a country have to realize is that without immigrant labor, this country would be radically different and very expensive. I mean, go to Japan. It's like $4 for an orange. Is that what you want? And this isn't just about Mexican labor. It's about cheap labor, which we're addicted to. This dates back to the turn of the last century, when canned food was all the rage. Now, who worked in the canning factories? European immigrants. You're a bright audience, so I know you get this, but if you need a history lesson on this, I suggest you read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. I had to read this for a literature class in college, and it was a game changer for me. Yes, it was a novel, but it adequately illustrated the harsh conditions and the exploitation of immigrants in the United States in the meatpacking industry in the 1900s. There were health violations, unsanitary practices, and a complete and utter lack of humanity as it pertained to immigrants. After the book came out, the American public got so pissed off that it led to the Meat Inspection Act. Teddy Roosevelt said that Sinclair was a crackpot, a socialist. He wasn't shy about his contempt for him, called him unbalanced, untruthful, saying that a majority of the things that he wrote were falsehoods, like the original fake news. Then he read The Jungle, and suddenly, he agreed with him. Then he acted. He gave a shit about immigrants, because he realized, hey, they were human beings too, and they were the backbone of what drove our nation's capitalism. We've always relied on cheap labor to get things done and to make things profitable. And who does those things? The immigrants. They're hungry. They'll work. Take away the people who do this work, and things slow way down, get way more expensive, and suddenly, you have a massive recession on your hands. So listen, you want to make America great again? You can start by becoming reasonable and take it from there.
There's a lot about your lawsuit. Obviously, you can't talk about it. It's an ongoing litigation. The president is suing you for $10 million, you're countersuing, I believe, for $8 million. When you first launched this suit, you said More than half my team is Hispanic, as are many of our guests, and as a proud Spanish immigrant and recently naturalized American citizen myself, I believe that every human being deserves respect regardless of immigration status. Has anything changed? I mean, the lawsuit still continues, yes?
Unfortunately, yes. On Twitter, I offer peace.
Right, you offered to donate money, both sides donate money to a charity.
I offer it because he has to run the country. The president has to try to do that, no easy task. And I have to run my little group of restaurants. So why we don't put that on the side and everybody does what should be doing? Fortunately, no response yet. But
your little group of restaurants is pretty huge.
We have 25 now. And you know, for me, it's very clear. When I did what I had to do, I actually, around the end of June of 2015, I got a phone call of then the Republican candidate, Mr. Donald Trump himself.
So before you actually had this lawsuit, when you were first,
yes,
it was just going to be you in business together, while he was a candidate, you got a phone call from him.
I got a phone call because kind of we said, listen, Mr. Trump cannot be commenting on immigrants and on Mexicans as rapists and other types of things. I am an immigrant myself and a Hispanic Mexican myself. This is not going to be good for business. So, hey, he's hands-on. He gave me a phone call. He said, Jose, we're winning. I was like, Mr. Trump, I'm not running on your ticket. I only want to run a successful restaurant, and you are making it very difficult.
So he had heard that you were concerned about this?
Yes, through probably his daughter Ivanka and his son, Donald Trump Jr. And quite frankly, I said, we need to behave in a different way. And then he kind of, very surprising to me, very much said, Jose, I know you have very strong beliefs about immigration reform. Why after New Hampshire, we don't see it and we talk about immigration reform? I'm like, Mr. Trump, this is almost 9 months away. I need to find a solution to what's happening right now. And right now you are making, with your comments, our business almost impossible.
I don't know how many of you stuck around after I put the show on an indefinite hiatus, but I did continue to shoot some video. If you haven't been, check out my YouTube page if you're interested in any of that. I started a series called My Life as a Foodie in the Kitchen. I made potato leek soup, showed how to make pastrami at home, even did another episode of Out to Lunch. And I will say this, commenters on YouTube can be real assholes sometimes. I don't know who saw my pastrami video first, but a rash of people started commenting all at once, and it was all mean-spirited. I mean, listen, I enjoyed the hits it was getting, but the comments I certainly could have done without. Who gets upset about this shit? I deleted every single one of them, turned commenting off. Listen, everyone has an opinion, even on something as simple as how to make pastrami. This is ridiculous. One guy said it was a great video right up until the time I printed a curse word on screen. I don't even remember what I said, as I didn't do voiceovers for that one. I was trying to make it funny. I think I said bitch or something. But honestly, people curse all over the place on YouTube, and my videos carry an explicit tag even when I don't curse. I just want to keep kids out, you know? Took everything in my power not to type back to him. I almost typed back telling him to go back to sucking his mother's titties. But I just decided I'll turn off comments altogether. I've often talked about the anonymity of the internet and how courageous people can be when they're sitting behind the keyboard, but I guarantee you not one single one of those motherfuckers would have had the balls to say that shit to my face. Because I would humiliate the shit out of you in public, trust me. You want that? Come to my face, I dare you. Bunch of pussies. One of the projects I'd started, then stopped after about 4 episodes, was a podcast called Eat, Go, Repeat, which is not about eating, taking a dump, and then eating some more. It was about fitness and nutrition, how to maintain a healthy, sustainable lifestyle while still eating really good-tasting food. But after a few episodes and a video where I took you on a 6-mile run with me, I started to realize that I was coming off as a little preachy in an arena where I really didn't feel like I fit in. And it wasn't the direction I wanted to take it. I sat on it for a while. I tried to formulate a plan where I didn't do that, but still sticking to my original idea. Just felt uncomfortable. I didn't feel good about it, so I shelved it. It was a good show, too. I felt great about it. It just didn't stick. So for those of you who stuck through that with me, my deepest apologies for trashing it. And my sincerest thanks for supporting me while I did it. I did really have high hopes for it. I had about 10 scripts lined up for the In the Kitchen series too, and hopefully I can find some time to put those together. They're pretty funny. When I made the potato leek soup video, there's a step where you have to blend the soup, either using a hand blender or a regular blender, but the soup has to be hot while you do it. Now listen, this can be a disaster in a regular blender if you don't keep pressure on the lid when you turn it on. So I made my point clear that if you decide not to use a hand blender and use a stand blender and don't keep the lid on tight, you'd end up getting bukkakied by hot potato leek soup, and that sucks.
If you use a standard blender, you're going to need to blend the soup in batches, taking care not to fill the blender too high and keeping pressure on the lid, or you're going to run the risk of hot potato soup all over your kitchen and your face. Now think of it this way. If you like hot potato bukkake facials, use a regular blender.
Maybe it's a midlife crisis I'm going through or something, I don't know. But I've really been working on my attitude towards some important things in my life, at least things that I think are important. One is cycling, which I love and I've loved it for over 20 years. And the other is diet, which is something that I'm always looking for new approaches to. So there's this guy, his name is Grant Peterson. He's worked in the bike industry for a number of years, eventually started his own business making bikes, Rivendell Bicycle Works. Big heavy steel bikes with cages and baskets and old school Dutch looking bikes. He's written two books, both of which I bought. I've just finished one and I'm just starting the other. And I want to talk about the one I'm about to start, but I'll save that discussion for later after I'm able to read it and digest it. But there's a reason why what he writes speaks to me. It's about filtering through the bullshit, the preconceived notions about things that we've grown to believe is true, but aren't. His book on cycling is called Just Ride. It basically tears down the ideas that I've held about cycling since I started getting serious about it. It's really influenced by road racing, professional cycling. And if you know anything about professional cycling, it's pretty messed up. I'm that guy who rides the ultralight road bike on skinny tires, wearing the Lycra jersey and what looks like a diaper or long underwear, going as fast as I can, passing as many other riders as I can, inflicting as much pain on my body as I can while I'm on the bike. And for years I've been obsessed with how many miles I can fit into a week, how fast I can finish a sector, how I compare to other riders who ride the same routes that I do. And when my Strava app malfunctions or I forget to turn it on, it ruins my day and nullifies what should have been a good day on the bike. I've been obsessed with it for way too long. And looking back on it, I'm not sure I've really enjoyed my time on the bike as much as I could have. I mean, I ride a bike with tires so skinny, if I hit a pebble, I start to worry about a flat. That's just not right. After reading his book, I realized just how much professional cycling has influenced my experience on the bike and my outlook while I'm on it. I just hit 52, okay? I think my days of being an asshole, wannabe amateur club racer on a bike are over. I'm tired of being so serious about it. It's time to enjoy what years I have left on those two wheels. Granted, I've never been one of those assholes who are so arrogant to others. You know, I say hello to everybody. I chat it up. I don't do rude shit to people. I obey traffic laws. I don't run red lights or blast through stop signs like I do in my car. It's my internal attitude on the bike that burns me up. It's what's happening in my head. That's not who I am on a day-to-day basis. So why does that change in my head once I get on the bike? It's influence. So I'm in the process of selling my road bike. I'm looking to replace it with a steel gravel bike that will slow me down, allow me to ride both on the road, off the road, start to enjoy myself. Maybe I'll put some fenders on it. Maybe a basket to carry groceries. It helped me enjoy cycling a little bit more. Maybe a nice comfortable seat instead of that hard plastic thing that hurts my ass. No more skin-tight clothes, street clothes only. When I get off my bike, I don't want to embarrass my kids by what I'm wearing. Looks like I'm in my underwear. I stopped clipping into my bike after I split my head open in an accident because I was clipped in. Not only that, if you stop by a coffee shop, you either have to take your shoes off or walk gingerly in these ballet slippers or the cleats are going to slide all over the floor and you'll land on your ass in that giant diaper. Hell, I might even wear sandals on the bike if I feel like it. I don't give a shit anymore. I want to feel like a kid again on this thing. And that's the whole thing that got me into cycling anyway. That feeling of freedom, having fun, getting away for a while. Why I allowed myself to feel that pressure of beating myself up is beyond me. Cycling is one of the most unhealthy sports in the world. Check it out. Look it up. It's not good for you. Not when you're doing that. I was influenced by all the wrong things, the wrong people. But like I said, it's never too late to change some things. Now the second book, which applies to the show, and I can't wait to read it and share it with you, is called Don't Jog, Eat Bacon, Get Strong, Get Lean, No Bullshit. Long title. Now from what I've read so far, it will change your thinking on food and workouts and why attempts to lose weight permanently often fail. How eating nutritious fat and doing short bursts of exercise reverses everything. He talks about carbs and how dangerous they really are to our body's insulin levels. How to fast properly and why you should do it from time to time. In full disclosure, the secret to my weight loss was intermittent fasting from time to time. I would do it maybe once a week. I would try to fast for an extended period of time. Not the whole day, but a lot of it. Turns out you really can eat too much protein. And how most of your calories really should come from fat. I know this sounds ridiculous, but people have followed this. The results are amazing. Turns out breakfast is not the most important meal of the day. Actually, it is the most important meal of the day to skip. There's a truth about whole grains, how to control your blood pressure, why you shouldn't jog, and why sprinting intervals is key. If you can't jog yourself skinny, why are the world's best distance runners skinny? Think about it. How to properly exercise. Why the kettlebell is the only piece of weight equipment you probably ever need. How cancer thrives on glucose but can't live on ketones. How bad advice from the pros has influence beyond the point of no return. It's a lot to process, and I can't wait to read it all and share it with you. But until I do, allow me to share this with you. Since I've talked about Bourdain so much today, this is from Bourdain's Appetites Cookbook, which I've been cooking from like crazy since it came out a few months ago. If you follow me on Instagram, you've probably seen some of the dishes I've made from it. They're all delicious, and nothing takes that long to prepare. It's home food. It's not rocket science, just really humble food. So we're going to make Vietnamese Duchua salad. I'm probably saying that wrong. Duchua? D-O-C-H-U-A. It's got herbs, scallions, sprouts, and egg. The recipe's on the website. Okay, I'll put everything on the website, but you can follow along here. First thing you want to do is you want to make some Nguoc Mam Cham. Is that how you say this? Nguoc Mam Cham. It's a Vietnamese dipping sauce. You could use it as a salad dressing or dip spring rolls into it. It's sweet and delicious and inherently Vietnamese.
It's so horny.
Okay, in a small mixing bowl, whisk 1/4 cup of freshly squeezed lime juice, 3 tablespoons of sugar, and 1/4 cup of water. Now, you're going to start whisking, and you're going to add 2 to 3 tablespoons of Vietnamese fish sauce in increments as you continue to whisk. Taste as you go, and 2 should do it, but if you want it more earthy, continue to add more until it tastes really good to you. This stuff smells like you just took off a pair of underwear that you've been wearing for a week. But trust me, it doesn't taste anything like it smells. It's that umami flavor that you like so much. You don't know what that is? It's umami. Don't be afraid of it. Add it to your sauce. After you're done whisking, and it tastes like you want it, toss in 1 fresh Thai chili pepper that you finely diced, and 1 finely chopped garlic clove, and that's your sauce. It's unbelievable, trust me. If you have any leftover, you can cover the container, keep it in the fridge, will last up to a week. Okay, now for the salad. In a large mixing bowl, combine 4 medium carrots that you've peeled and julienned, 1 large daikon radish, also peeled and julienned, 1 teaspoon of salt, 2 teaspoons of sugar, toss that all together. Toss it very, very well. You're going to want to let this sit for about 1/2 hour, and then toss the liquid that collects beneath the vegetables. Take all the vegetables out, squeeze them dry with a paper towel, rinse and dry the bowl that you had them in, return the vegetables to that bowl along with 2 more tablespoons of sugar, 1/4 cup of white vinegar, and 1/4 cup of sherry vinegar. Add 3/4 of a cup of hot water to this, Then cover it and let it sit for 1 hour. Now this can be served immediately as a salad, or you can hold it in the fridge. It'll last for up to 3 weeks. When you're ready to serve this, remove the datura from the bowl with the tongs to a clean mixing bowl or a serving platter. Leave behind whatever brine is left in there. If some gets on and gets in your bowl, that's fine, but you want to leave as much of it behind as you can. Top it with one bunch of scallions that are thinly sliced, 2 cups of crisp soybean sprouts, and 4 hard-boiled eggs that you've peeled and quartered. Mix this together and then top it with 1 cup of fresh basil leaves, 1 cup of fresh mint leaves, and 1 cup of fresh cilantro leaves. Taste it, season it with Mok Mom Cham or the sriracha sauce, because listen, when all else fails, nothing goes better on just about anything more than sriracha. I'll drizzle that shit on my cereal sometimes. Just not Kashi. Bam! And that's the show. Thanks for listening to me ramble for, I don't know, what's it been, an hour? I have a lot to say, I'm sorry. I have more, but my mouth is getting really dry, so I'll save it for next time. Audio courtesy of The Onion and CNN. Music in this episode from Calvin Harris and Ray Sremmerd. If you like the music, check out the links on our website, mylifeasafoodie.com. Purchase the songs, support the artists. Until next time, my name is Phil, and this has been My Life as a Foodie. Now go toss that salad.
He's so horny.
Machine to the club for, and a pint of lean, pound of weed, and a keto.